From Lakeshore Public Radio, this is Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. We have a chance to talk with the new president at Valparaiso University, Jose Padilla. Thank you for joining us, and welcome back to the Midwest and to Northwest Indiana.
Thank you, Chris. I'm looking forward to it.
And you've had a chance, of course, to come back into the Midwest after having worked for DePaul University in Chicago. Did you find the atmosphere any different from leaving and having worked up in the Chicago area to come back to Porter County?
No, there's so much of the Midwestern values and the culture here. My family and I would spend a lot of time in the dunes on weekends during the summer, so we're very familiar with this area, and we're just happy to be back.
What attracted you to the opportunity to come to work for Valparaiso University?
To work for, one, a faith-based institution. I had obviously done that at DePaul University for 15 years, and I just love the mission of a faith-based institution where we combine faith and wisdom empower and transform the lives of students, to not only make them educated citizens, but also enlightened and spiritual citizens.
Tell us
what I missed at DePaul, and that's what I'm getting here at Valparaiso.
Will you take a few minutes and talk a little bit about what you had done at DePaul and how it fits in so nicely with what you're doing now at VU?
Sure. I was the general counsel and later on the board secretary as well at DePaul, and had various other interim positions, but I was a member of the president's cabinet, in other words, his leadership team of what was and is still the largest Catholic university in the nation. So in this position, I was helping oversee and advise on various issues, not just legal ones. As a member of his cabinet, everything was fair game and on the table, so I was able to really have a catbird seat in how a major university operates, again, particularly a faith-based one like DePaul is. And those skills were transferable to my position here at Valparaiso,
right. Where,
again, at a smaller scale, but those are still lessons that I am bringing to the table here as well.
And we should mention as well that after having worked at DePaul, you ended up working with the University of Colorado system. As your role as vice president as well as university counsel, did you find that there were similarities, certainly between that job in the Chicago area and the ones that attracted you to back to Indiana?
Well, what was interesting about Colorado is, first of all, it was a public university system versus, DePaul and Valparaiso, which are privates. It was interesting to see the differences, but at the same token, a lot of the challenges that Valparaiso and DePaul face, University of Colorado faces, of course, one being COVID, but also other issues as well, and they have a lot of the same problems we do, but with just a lot more zeros. And again, these are all lessons that I bring with me, because obviously, Valparaiso not only competes with other universities, but we particularly compete with large public institutions. And having worked at Colorado, it gives me insight about how publics operate, but also how I can put Valparaiso in a better position to compete with those universities.
What challenges first do you see that you're going to be facing as the new head of Valparaiso University?
Well, first off is COVID. I think we're doing a good job in keeping our positivity rate low. Our students are very, very cooperative and compliant with our restrictions because they understand it's for the good of the entire campus community. The second one is the financial challenges that a small private university has when it's tuition dependent. And so that's always going to be an issue at these kind of schools. DePaul was tuition dependent, and it's just a larger school, so that will be a big challenge. And then also just understanding what we're going to look like after we get past COVID. Will things return to normal? I doubt it. Mm-hmm. I think there are going to be substantial changes, and we're going to have to lean into those changes in a big way.
You talk about what you're looking ahead for the university. Is there a vision, or do you think there will have to be a vision if it hasn't been one established yet that you're going to have to establish?
Well, I'm in the course of establishing that vision only because I'm meeting with the faculty and the students and the staff and our alumni and our external neighbors here in Northwest Indiana. So that's helping inform the decision. With respect to academics, it continues to be meeting the legacy of being an excellent academic institution with a strong emphasis on service once in the university and once they get out. I want to be faithful to that legacy. But there will be other decisions that we'll have to make because, again, any college or university has been, in one way or another, been changed by COVID. And those changes we're going to have to adapt to and then exploit the advantages as well as avoid the disadvantages once we get past COVID.
Now, I know that you've had a chance at least to get to meet some people. In fact, let's take a moment and bring some comments that you had from students and got to talk with some students from earlier this month during your first day on the job at Valparaiso University.
I am so excited and optimistic about being president of this great university. But my hope and prayer is that we constantly remember to embrace the vocation and devotion we have to each other.
He's a great man. I'm really excited to see the things he does as a leader here on campus.
He can't be that impressed with me yet because I got to prove myself, but he's already proved himself to the Valpo community.
I just finished a wonderful and enlightening tour at the Center for the Sciences. I'm just so impressed with facilities and how they're state of the art.
Welcome to Valpo.
Thank you very much. It's been a great day.
So, well, it was nice meeting you guys. Thank you so much for everything you do for us.
Yes. This has been a great day, meeting the people who are the backbone of this university. So looking forward to meeting so many more people, and I look forward to getting to know even better as time goes by.
After those comments that you've heard, let's find out more. President Padilla, will you fill us in on have opportunity of talking with some of the faculty members, and then you're going to continue discussions, of course. What have they mentioned to you?
Well, I think, again, they're very committed. They have staked their professional lives on again, educating young men and women, and they are devoted to this institution. They want me to obviously treat them in a very transparent, honest way, and that's what I intend to do because they are our partners, particularly on the academic side, as a matter of this principle called shared governance, which is prevalent in any major university or college across the country, where there are partners in devising and implementing the academic programs of the university. So I intend to be transparent and honest with them and consult them seriously because, again, they know this institution so much better than I do at this point in time. They're committed to it, so I'd be foolhardy to disregard or not consult their views. So, again, I think they're committed. They love this place, and their love is infectious. And my wife and I are just so impressed by the devotion the faculty and staff have to this institution.
That's great to hear. Now, I know you had an opportunity when you came into the job as the president-elect back at the first of the year. You had a chance to work with the interim president, Colette Irwin Knott. What was a working relationship like at that time? What did you get to do in the time span that you had before actually taking over earlier this month as the president?
Well, I spent 2 months as president-elect working with Colette, and it was a great transition time for me just to absorb and learn as much as possible about the university. I met and spoke with almost every board member of our board of directors. I spoke with, you know, the leadership of the faculty senate, the staff leadership group, as well as the student leaders. I was able to meet with others who are integral to this university, including the vice presidents who now report to me. So it was a good way for me just to learn as much as possible and absorb it and get ready for this job full-time, March 1st.
Well, President Padilla, thank you for spending time with us, talking about yourself, about your vision, at least for the moment, as things are going to change for Valparaiso University. And you've had an opportunity to meet with many students and other people on campus in your first weeks, actually being the official president of VU. And we hope we have a chance to talk with you again about serious as well as not-so-serious matters coming up. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Chris. I look forward to further conversations with you.
Well, you're entirely welcome. Jose Padilla is the new president at Valparaiso University. As Indiana approached 1 year since the COVID-19 shutdown, daycare providers faced a new reality as they try to keep the doors open. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Priya Mahadevan reports that while facilities once grappled with a shortage of child care seats, now they're facing a shortage of children to fill them.
Tammy Lindblom is the program director of Right Steps Child Development Center, which operates multiple facilities in the Lafayette area. Since the pandemic began, every day presents a new challenge that she's never encountered before.
I was actually on the phone with the director. A grandma was exposed to her grandchildren who works in the center. What do we do? So it's like, okay, let's think about this one.
Lindblom oversees 7 facilities. Since the start of the pandemic, she's only had 2 center-wide closures due to COVID exposure. They've gotten better at restricting teachers and students to certain classrooms. But COVID exposure is not Lindblom's only issue.
Our enrollment has probably dropped lower than it has in years. Our goal is always to be around 90% enrolled, and midstream of all this, none of my centers were over like 65%.
Take Lindblom's facility next to Purdue University, where enrollment tanked after the university sent thousands of employees home last spring. That daycare center's manager still hasn't entirely recovered from that shock.
Actually, just today we were celebrating because she's finally back up to 60%.
And where did she start at, like, the beginning of the pandemic?
Oh, she started at, you know, almost 70. So. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yep.
Having low daycare enrollment is new for Indiana, especially among childcare facilities like the one Lindblom operates, those graded as high quality by the state. In fact, a lack of quality childcare seats in both urban and rural areas was one of the biggest issues facing the industry even just a year ago.
If we'd been having this conversation in 2019, we would have been talking about exactly that.
That's Maureen Weber, the executive director of Early Learning Indiana.
There are places in the state where there are childcare deserts, where for a particular audience especially, there is not sufficient access.
But in the last year, even Weber has seen the high-demand facilities that Early Learning Indiana helps operate drop to as low as 15% its pre-pandemic enrollment levels, with significant repercussions for their bottom line.
And this is an industry that barely breaks even on a good day.
Childcare facilities have many requirements, like staff-to-children ratios and safety regulations for kitchens and play areas. All that costs money, and it means childcare margins are often razor thin, even before COVID-19.
And so it doesn't take much at all to put entities out of alignment and make it really hard for them to continue to operate, and that's where lots of providers around the state are.
So what does the pandemic mean for the future of childcare? It's unclear. Nearly $70 million in statewide grants helped boost Indiana's daycare providers and keep them open and safe. So far, just a few providers that accept childcare vouchers from low-income families have had to close in the past year. Yet, a recent state survey found that 1 in 5 providers weren't sure they could make it to the end of the pandemic.
I think there's just a lot of ambiguity in the numbers, and we're all sort of wondering what this means.
For now, many of the providers that received pandemic support money from the state say it was life-saving. Tammy Lindblom, the childcare program director in Lafayette, says that extra money was vital to keeping her centers running through their prolonged drop in enrollment.
Even though we closed down for 2 weeks, we still have to pay rent. You know, we still have to pay lights. We still have to do all of that. So knowing that we have this little cushion, like, we don't have to worry about going out and spending on markers because we have some support for that.
Looking ahead, all eyes are on the Biden administration's next round of COVID relief funding, which currently allocates $40 billion to distribute for childcare. More than half of that $40 billion would go towards fulfilling basic needs like rent and utilities. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Priya Mahadevan.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Nestled on the south end of the Purdue University main campus in West Lafayette, in a rather nondescript building amongst all the others that are in that area, happens to be a place where there are some real treasures that have come from the Purdue University campuses, all of the campuses, not only the main campus, that are up for surplus to be sold. The surplus store has been in operation for quite a while, and let's find out some of the latest operations and things that are up for sale these days. We have with us the operations manager for the Purdue University Surplus Operations, Susan Tyson. Now, Susan, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, thanks for having us. Appreciate it, Chris.
Will you take a few moments and talk about the history of the surplus store? How long has surplus store been in operation at Purdue University, and the evolution from where it started to where it is today?
Well, the surplus store actually has been in existence since mid-60s. We kind of started out also in another nondescript building off campus as a once a month auction. And from that, we have evolved into nowadays an actual retail store that you can come in and shop through the week, Monday through Friday.
I know that some of the items come from buildings on campus. Some of these items are surprising. Some are kind of ordinary. For example, I know that if there happens to be some changes in furnishings in the residence halls on campus, or maybe office equipment or office furniture, it will get shuttled out. There is the idea first that they do what you can to find another home for them someplace on campus before they go to the surplus store?
Exactly, it is. The idea is to just be a good steward of the university's funds and try to find other homes for these items that departments no longer need. There's an internal listing for these items that other departments can shop before they come to the surplus store. So, mm-hmm. Yes, we would like to repurpose them within the university before we actually sell them.
What items typically get repurposed on campus before they end up going down to the store?
We have seen, Chris, just about everything you can imagine. Your typical items are going to be, your basic office and classroom things, your desks, your chairs, your file cabinets, those types of things. We get a lot of scientific equipment from labs when they're considered obsolete, or, you know, maybe a lab closes down, a professor goes somewhere else, and they reestablish it as another lab for someone else. So
right.
We get everything from your basic office equipment to vehicles. We sell the university's vehicles. That includes things like farm implements, because the university has a lot of regional farms that they operate out of. Fire trucks. We've sold our fire trucks. We sell our police cars. We sell our airplanes that the students in the School of Aviation and Transportation Technology train in also.
Wow. In fact, I know that the good example of that are a couple of planes that are up for sale by right now, I understand.
Yeah, we utilize an auction site called govdeals.com. And right now we have two of our airplanes, they're Cirrus SR-20s, up for auction. We have actually four airplanes left out of 16. So those are currently up for auction on govdeals.com. And I think the auction ends Monday the 29th. So if any of your listeners are interested, they might want to check that out.
Yeah, good idea. Now, besides the airplanes and besides the office furniture and, I guess, furnishings out of the residence halls if they get changed out, you have some pretty big projects, and one in particular that's gotten support here in Northwest Indiana to be changed out. And we're talking about all of the things that are happening at the Purdue Memorial Union and the hotel and the food services area there. Will you tell us about all of the material that has come out of those as they are being refurbished and revamped, and how they're going to be taken care of at the surplus store?
Yeah, we help out on campus with a lot of remodeling. For example, a few years ago when the athletic department built the new football practice complex, they moved the old football locker room into the new complex. So we sold all of the old lockers and all the old equipment out of the old football locker room, so they could remodel that. And now that's kind of what we just are wrapping up with the union, Purdue Memorial Union.
Mm-hmm.
The ground floor is retail dining, and that's going through a major remodel. And we just cleaned out all of the equipment of the kitchens. I mean, we're talking stoves and pizza ovens and woks and, you know, dining tables and dining chairs and all kinds of equipment from that ground floor, completely gutted it.
Wow. Well, it sounds like all those items that are now going to the surplus store might be a good idea for somebody who wants to open a restaurant to stop over and bid on some of these things or buy them outright to furnish that restaurant they maybe want to start, open up sometime, to be sure. And I was referring earlier to the help up here in Northwest Indiana. We know that the project overall that's happening at the Purdue Memorial Union Hotel is a large part being helped out by the White Foundation that's based here in Maryville.
White Lodging just opened up the Union Hotel a few months ago, and prior to them coming in and doing their huge remodel, we cleaned out about I think it was 190 hotel rooms, beds and TVs and, you know, all of that stuff so they could go in and start their remodel. And it turned out beautiful. They did a wonderful job on that.
Now, how have things changed from before the pandemic to now during the pandemic as far as handling these items that go to surplus and how they're sold at surplus at the store?
Typically, the way they're handled has pretty much stayed the same. A lot of campus support staff are working remotely, so there's some challenges in, you know, getting things picked up from campus, and it's just really arranging a specific day rather than just being able to drop into a building and say, hey, we're here to pick your stuff up.
Right.
But our sales adjusted a little bit. About a year ago, this time we closed to walk-in customers for a few months. We were able to reopen our regular hours. I think it was after Memorial Day. So in that period that we were closed, we really utilized our govdeals.com site. We have a Facebook site and an Instagram site that we kind of sold things from there and did curbside pickups. So we adjusted just like everybody else had to in doing less contact sales, minimal contact sales. But we chugged right along and kept on going.
Well, Susan, how have the response from members of the public that are interested in buying things, they've seen things, checked out things online as they have through the websites and the like, how's that turned out as far as sales for the Purdue University Surplus Store turned out?
Oh, it's been fabulous. You mentioned the restaurant equipment. We have had numerous local restaurants come in and pick up some of that equipment from the ground floor retail dining remodel.
It's just
been really a good influx and a benefit to our local restaurants that have been able to pick that equipment up at a huge discount. You know, that's probably one of our hardest hit industries is the restaurant dining area. So they were able to get it at a discount and update some of their equipment without, you know, putting out and going into extra debt time of year.
Now, Susan, if anybody is interested in checking out these items that are offered at the Purdue University Surplus Store there on the West Lafayette campus, how can they find out more now? And maybe even put a bid on that airplane if they happen to want one.
Well, like I said, we do utilize govdeals.com for a lot of our larger equipment. A lot of our combines and tractors and things like that we can't park in our store, so you can come in and look at it. So we do utilize govdeals.com. We utilize Facebook a lot, try to sell things on that. We have a huge following on Facebook and try to advertise what we have in the store so people can kind of see what it is. And our Instagram page. We have a website which is purdue.edu/surplus. But we don't do a lot of selling off of that site. Most of that is on our GovDeals site and our Facebook page. That's where a lot of that happens, where the public can see what we have. We have limited hours, and I have to agree with a lot of people that kind of say, well, you're only open 12 to 4, and it's hard for me to get there. So that's why we kind of try to put this stuff on social media.
Sure.
But what they don't understand is those other hours that we're out trying to pick up these things to get into the stores.
Well,
we have a really small staff of like 7 people. So it's really difficult for us to be there 24/7. We like to be on vacation and at home with our families.
I suppose you can go on the Purdue University website on the purdue.edu/surplus and you can get the hours and where the store is located. So if you do want to find out and go on and contact you folks, and if you do want to take a look and find something there that you can do so, as long as you make arrangements saying, hey, we're going to come by at a certain time, when it happened, the hours happen to be most advantageous to everybody, I suppose. So it's a way to check things out. Certainly the other website is the best way to look at these large items that you have for sale. And if you want to find out more about the surplus store hours, you can go on the purdue.edu /surplus and look up information that way, too. Susan, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about the surplus store at Purdue University in the main campus of West Lafayette. And we hope that the continued sales keep growing and growing. It sounds like you're certainly on your way to big sales some more.
We are, and appreciate you letting us tell the people up north where we are, because we do a lot of the Purdue Northwest campus items. Well, we've I've done some child care equipment and things up there. We've sold from there. So we are pretty much all over the state, whether you see us or not.
Susan Tyson is the operations manager for the Purdue University Surplus Operations, which runs the Surplus store on the south end of the main campus in West Lafayette. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks very much for being with us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.